Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. Over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you are tuning in live or catching the podcast later, stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers and key newsmakers. It is everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp and straight to the point. It's Monday, the 28th of October. Coming up, why South Africa could be staying on the grey list longer than initially thought. Some future gazing on what to expect from Wednesday's mini-budget. The reasons behind September's remuneration figures showing the highest take-home pay yet. The local manufacturing sector remains resilient. We'll ask if it's adaptable and what the upcoming US election outcome could mean for taxes, trade and tech. All right, let's start with this. South Africa's path to exiting the Financial Action Task Force grey list may extend beyond June next year and possibly even into October as regulatory compliance demands continue to grow. Now, add to all of this the upcoming mini-budget this week, and all of this is playing a pivotal role in shaping the country's financial stability amid escalating deficits and economic challenges. With me now, economist Davi Ruit from the Efficient Group, a regular guest on this program. Davi, welcome to you. What's your sense then about the grey list, sooner or later?
Jeremy, good afternoon to you. I probably think a little bit later. I don't think we're going to see. It's a bit of like the end of next year we will be off the grey list. I had the opportunity to be a speaker at an anti-laundering conference not too long ago, a month or so ago, and I spoke to international analysts there, and they told me there really is only one thing that we need to do. We need to take the Zondo Commission and just go through the Zondo Commission and charge those people that are mentioned in the Zondo Commission. Only doing that will make it clear that South Africa is serious about money laundering and so on. Well, of course, there are a couple of other things that are important as well. But doing that, of course, you need political will for that. And I don't think the prosecuting authorities in South Africa are really strong enough to really prosecute where necessary. Mm-hmm. But that is really the only major outstanding item at the moment.
And Davi Ruit, if that's the case, then if we have a delay in exiting this list, it's obviously going to have an impact, one, on investor confidence. You've been speaking to international investors. And secondly, it does have a debilitating impact on economic growth, does it not?
Without a doubt, I am in a game where I take people's money out of the country and manage it internationally. And I can tell you it's a huge slip if I have to keep on going back to my clients and tell them, listen, I want proof of your address. I want proof of the source of the funds. And the international banks make life very, very difficult for us. And it's quite often what happens is that the international financial institutions say, this is just too much trouble to do business with South Africans. They don't want to do business with South Africans. And all that, of course, adds up. And it's quite expensive to try to do business internationally. It is really bad for economic growth.
So, Davi, if I gave you 2 minutes in front of the Treasury's next ExCo meeting and you've got two slides to present, what would you give them?
I will certainly just put them the front page of the first page of the Zondo Commission and tell them this is what you need to do. Just follow the recommendations of the Zondo Commission and everything will fall in place. I think that is the single most important thing that should be done and can be done. For the rest, I think we're doing pretty fine. I think Treasury is trying to do what they can to get everybody to comply with the various legislations and so on, but just prove that we are actually in a position where we can prosecute people and everything else will fall in place.
All right, Davi Ruit, 48 hours to go. Then we've got the mini budget. How tight is that tightrope?
It's going to be very tight. Let's just go through the major items. On the revenue side, it seems as if revenue is under some pressure. The one good news on the revenue side is that the two-pot system is likely to result in some additional inflows to the Minister of Finance. But in total, I would say the revenue is slightly below budget. On the expenditure side, there's huge pressure on the Minister of Finance. One is that the state-owned enterprises, Telkom, for example, or rather the post office, for example, is one And of course, Eskom is always there, and Transnet is also there. All want money. And of course, there's requirements for money for education. I know the new Minister of Basic Education, she wants more money. The civil servants, they've been offered 4.7% increase. I can't believe that the state actually offered them a 4.7% increase. And if you put all of that together, we're probably talking about a fiscal deficit in the region of about 5% or so. So a little bit worse than the minister envisaged in his budget at the beginning of the year. And that also means that the debt to GDP ratio is likely to be a little bit higher.
Go ahead, Davi.
What I'm quite excited about, there's a possibility that the Minister of Finance may announce slightly lower inflation targets, perhaps something like 4%. Not a band anymore, perhaps 4%. I hope so.
It's not just about the numbers and policy announcements, Davi. It's also about the tone that he sets. And he's going to have to walk that one very carefully, given that international markets particularly are looking for some kind of sentiment analysis here.
Yeah, I think so far he's not been doing too badly. We're running a primary surplus at the moment. If you exclude interest on state debt, then it's actually a surplus, which is a good thing, which means that the Minister of Finance is serious in getting the fiscal deficit and the debt down over time. And if he can set the right tone, and if the international markets and local markets actually believe him, then there's quite easily another 100 basis points on the capital market. Interest rates, the long-term interest rates, can quite easily come down another 100 bips or so, and that in itself will be good news for the fiscal deficit and the fiscal accounts in general. So yes, it is important for him to set the right tone.
I'm well aware, Davi, that this particular speech doesn't address tax adjustments, but what kind of clues would you be looking for?
On the revenue side, there's really not much that he can do. Now, yes, of course, this is not the opportunity for the minister to make major adjustments and announcements as far as fiscal policy is concerned. But between the lines, quite often one can pick a couple of things up. It is a so-called rolling budget, so we can get a bit of an idea of what the future of fiscal deficits and revenue and so on is going to look like. On the revenue side, there's really very little that he can do. Perhaps some announcement on a couple of food items, basic items that will be exempt from that, which will be a bad idea, just by the way. So there could be an indication on that. And maybe on the expenditure side, something like more spending on a basic income grant and perhaps something on a national health insurance. And of course, the wage bill as well. But actual announcements is only to be expected in February next year.
And reports finally, Davi, emerging today of this fiscal anchor proposal supported by the ANC. The head of the Economic Committee, Mameluke Kubai, wanting more focus on responsible spending. Put your economist's hat on and explain to me why this fiscal anchor concept is either a good or a bad thing.
Well, it's a good idea. The fiscal anchor concept is a good idea because what it does, it's like inflation targeting. It puts a number out there. And typically what a fiscal anchor will be a debt to GDP anchor or limitation, like what the Americans have. The Americans got a certain debt ceiling, and they're not supposed to exceed that debt ceiling. What happens in practice, every now and again, they simply increase the debt ceiling. But at least there is a number out there making it easy for the politicians to try to achieve that. Personally, I would rather prefer a so-called fiscal board that's got a little bit more power, and it's an independent board that changes, for example, the VAT rate to try to achieve a certain fiscal deficit relative to GDP, as an example. But yeah, I think it's not a bad idea. Treasury seems to be supporting that, but ANC not.
Davi Root, economist at the Efficient Group, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As South African take-home pay reaches new heights and salary growth remains buoyed by easing inflation as well as interest rates, consumers are slowly starting to see improved purchasing power, and just in time, I imagine, for the year-end shopping season. Don't forget, Black Friday is just around the corner. Right now, Elise Kruger is with me, independent economist at BankServe, and we're going to look at the trends behind these increases, how they're impacting spending potential, and what the future might hold for workers and, I guess, pensioners alike. So, first of all, Elise, this is good news, is it not? What factors are contributing most to the rise in take-home pay in the month of September?
Yes, indeed, it's good news, especially given that we've seen an upward trend during the course of the year. So it's definitely showing to me that the better business environment that we have experienced so far in 2024 has made a notable impact in the ability of companies to pay better salaries during this year compared to the previous few years.
So what type of increases are we seeing, or is it off a very low base still?
Yes, it's off a low base, I would say, because last year we had a fairly dismal year for salaries, actually the past 3 years. But if you look at it year to date, our increase in the Banks of Africa data is 6.3% in nominal terms compared to last year's full year. And in real terms, it translates into a 2.2% real increase, which is also quite notable because we haven't had a real increase in this economy at least for 2 to 3 years now.
Does your analysis look at the whole issue sectorally? In other words, are you able to tell us which sectors are doing better than others?
No, unfortunately not. Not the Banks of Africa data, as it's that take-home pay is basically calculated by taking the total value of all salaries paid into bank accounts and clearing through Banks of Africa as a clearinghouse, divided by the number of salaries. So it's really just an average for the economy as a whole. So the sectoral data that we've got in the economy is mostly from Stats SA, and unfortunately that lags a bit. So we only have data up till the second quarter. And I think that is also what makes Banks of Africa's data so usable, because it gives us an early indication of the next quarter already, quarter three, compared to waiting still for that data only to be released, I think, early December.
But we have a fairly benign environment, Elise, as you've mentioned. One is more positive news on inflation. We are expecting another 25 basis points cut this year, and also the declining negative impact of load shedding. That has a good impact on consumer confidence, particularly now that there's more money in our pockets.
Absolutely, Jeremy. I think consumer confidence, but also business confidence, it's actually right across the spectrum. And from that point of view, I think, you know, it's a good year for a bit of catch up in terms of salaries, because, you know, businesses have had a very hard time in the South African economy, especially last year and the year before that. So it's been difficult, you know, and to retain your employees and to keep them also happy. It's been difficult because they couldn't actually give a salary increase in line with inflation even. So this year, things are, you know, improving, and that's definitely translating in this type of positive trend that we are seeing on salary.
So Elise, if we have this positive trend, in other words, real pay increases, how do you see consumer spending patterns shifting in the short to medium term?
Indeed, I think we can see a positive uptick during the next, you know, current quarter and into next year as well. I mean, we are heading into Black Friday and, you know, sort of Black November sales, and I think that's going to be pretty good. I mean, if you look at just something like fuel price relief, that is an immediate saving in your pocket. You know, over the past 5 or so months, we've had cumulative relief in the order of about R4.50 per litre, depending on what's happening early next week on fuel prices. We might give back, say, 50 cents, but still cumulatively it's a notable reduction. So that's an immediate saving. And if you then add to that, you know, the lower interest rate scenario, by the time we get to end of November, we should have another 25 basis point cut on the table. So all of those adding, you know, and then you add on that, you know, slightly better confidence levels. You can even throw in the two-pot system that might also give a few more, you know, bucks to be spent in the economy, and you start to see consumer spending lifting up. However, one should remember that there's also a huge debt pile, especially on the household side. So some of this additional cash in the pocket might go to debt relief and not necessarily immediately to consumer spending.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Are you gleaning any early insights about the two-pot retirement system and how the money is being spent?
Jeremy, not specifically, I would say, anecdotal evidence yet, but some survey data from some of the pension funds have indicated, I think it was Old Mutual, saying that 60% of the people that asked, what are you going to do with your savings pot withdrawal, indicated that they will pay back debt. There was also an indication of paying for education. So these are, you know, so far people has not been saying, I'm going to go out and have a huge spending spree. But, you know, typically if there's extra money in your pocket, you might take a bit for yourself and the rest for the debt or something like that. But we haven't seen actual, I would say, data coming through yet. It's more survey related so far.
BankServe also makes an interesting observation about long-term wage agreements becoming the norm in more sectors. So these agreements are obviously going to impact wage stability. That would have a trickle-down effect on employer cost planning, which makes things a lot easier to manage.
Yes, indeed. You know, so on the one side, that is really positive. I thought about this a lot in the past week, you know, in the light of the debate around inflation targets. And what I was thinking is, you know, positive on the one side, as you mentioned, but on the other side, we have locked in quite, I would say, lucrative wage increases for the unionized sector of the economy. And that will build into the inflation numbers, you know, in the next 4 or 5 years as these wage agreements play out. And say we do have a reduction in our inflation target, you know, then it could remain, you know, a bit of a, I would say, negative for trying to get to a lower target, because we have locked in these type of wage agreements quite high salary increases. They're obviously positive for the workers, but for the overall economy, this could be an inflationary factor as we go into an environment where maybe the inflation target gets reduced.
And let me ask you one last question, if I can. We've got the Wednesday mini budget just ahead. Do you think it's going to be able to offer any relief for low to middle income households amid the settling but still concerning inflation environment?
Jeremy, the medium-term budget policy statement is not per se, I would say, the place where there would be relief announced like we normally have in our Feb budget. It's more a medium-term planning event. And in that regard, you know, I would not expect an announcement per se, say about, you know, social grants or about, the SRD grant or so. It's more in the planning. So one would perhaps watch out for sort of if there is additional appropriation for social spending on that side, for instance. But I doubt that we will see a specific announcement, you know, not typically in the October medium-term statement. It's more in FEEP that we could expect that type of announcement.
Elise Kruger, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's manufacturing sector, while a key contributor to the economy, faced significant challenges last year and this year, including rising costs and logistic disruptions. Now, as the sector navigates these hurdles, it's obviously becoming clear that digital transformation, reskilling and sustainability is going to be critical for future growth. I guess that applies to any industry. But how can this particular sector make those shifts? What systems are in place to ensure that the transformation is successful? Joining me now is Peter Theron, who is PwC Africa Industrials and Services Leader. And Peter, first of all, not too long ago, manufacturing accounting for around 27% of GDP. It's probably half that now. How much trouble do you think the sector is in?
There's definitely some challenges, if I can use those words. It hasn't been easy. Currently, the GDP generated by the manufacturing industry is about 13%. So you're rightly in terms of slightly less than half of that. And I mean, we've seen a lot of risks in that space, a lot of challenges that the manufacturing industry have to cope with. And I think we all are aware of the, let's call it, the infrastructure challenges in Africa, energy, water, access to skills. Those are the major drivers to some of the challenges that the companies don't really have control over, that they have to navigate with. That's apart from the internal challenges, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really difficult one because there's been a significant drop in net profit last year. So how are these companies planning to cut costs without sacrificing quality?
Yeah, the interesting thing that we've seen is that food and beverage sectors actually increased their profits. So they've grown by about 25%, whereas all the other sectors have come down. So if you think about the overall industry impact, different sectors sitting in that, and food and beverage have actually done remarkably well. And even though the revenue has come down, their net profit has gone up. So that tells us that those companies have definitely seen something happening on the one hand and made the necessary changes before some of the challenges hit the others. If you think about some of the other sectors like petrochemicals, paper and pulp, wood, iron and steel, commodities, and that's driven by international supply and demand. So the sales price is not something that they could control, whereas food and beverage can actually pass the sales price on to you and I. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've done better.
The report also talks about the priority of employee reskilling, but it's difficult for the industry to ensure that this happens and also aligns with technological advancements and, I guess, long-term business goals. How do they approach that strategically, do you think?
most of the CEOs that we've discussed, they fear that there will be a skill shortage. 45% of them, they fear a skill shortage in the coming years will affect their ability to run their business effectively. And I mean, that goes across the borders. If you look from, let's just call it artisans in the factories, millwrights, right from that area, right down to the other scale of middle senior management, digital skills, etc. Companies are spending a lot of money internally on training and development. They do realize that it's better for them to rather reskill their own employees rather than getting new ones and retrenching that. So we definitely see most of the people that we've spoken to realize that, and they're investing heavily into that space to make sure that they don't run out of skilled resources. So that's I think, number three risk for them on the scale is access to skills. So definitely very important.
Providing, of course, Peter, the unions are on board.
I think the unions always have to get on board. What I've seen is that when the unions are on board and people generally get paid more for the new skills that they acquire, it creates a happy environment across the board.
Of course, it's critical as well that these companies have systems in place to track the effectiveness of these reskilling programs and specifically the direct impact on productivity. If you don't do that, you're wasting your time.
Correct, yeah. What we've seen some of the companies do is that they determine what are the type of skills that we may need. In other words, how would an artisan's job change in 3 or 5 years' time? So we talk about the workforce of the future. How would an accountant's work change in 3 or 5 years' time? Obviously, from a manufacturing side, it's not only the shop floor workers, there's also engineers, there's industrial engineers, there's admin clerks, etc. And what some of the leading companies are doing, they're figuring out what are those skills that we foresee the company will need in the years ahead, and then they start proactively train employees on those skills. I know, for example, if I just use our own company as an example, we've picked three tools that we believe will make us more effective, and we have then put all and the entire staff through that training to actually help them to become more effective in their work. And we see the same happening in the industrial companies, the manufacturing companies.
Let me pivot from skilling to sustainability, if I can. The report also talks about how this has become increasingly important. But you will agree with me, it comes at a higher cost. So how can manufacturers plan to balance sustainability initiatives with profitability?
I think that's one of the big challenges that the industry grapple with at this stage. On the one hand, consumers are willing to pay more for sustainable products. Your point is that it comes at a cost. And we've seen that many companies have been forced over the last number of years to do a energy transition away from Eskom supplied power to sort of the more sustainable power supplies. So there's definitely energy transition thing taking place. But if we think about the entire sustainability scope, it's not only the energy that you buy from Eskom, it's also your production processes. It's also the procured carbon that you get. It's the waste that you produce, the water effluent, etc. And what we've seen is that where some companies have committed goals, they track those goals, they make announcements in the press around that. Most companies are struggling to get all of that in line, and then your point, how to do that cost effectively. We have seen many companies that are doing it cost effectively, but it's not going to be an ad hoc approach where we decide, let's switch the light bulbs, let's change the equipment, let's do that. It's almost like a holistic space to say that this is what we have to go do, this is how we'll reduce our carbon footprint, and these are the levers that will make the biggest impact. Once again, we've seen that the carbon that we buy, otherwise your scope 3 emissions, are actually the highest percentage of carbon emissions in most companies in the manufacturing industry. It can go up to as high as 60% in some of the sectors. So if you change your business internally, but you don't look at the carbon that you procure, you're actually putting your energy in the wrong space. And that's the kind of things that companies need to start doing to figure out what are those areas that we can spend money at for the highest return from a carbon perspective. And we've seen in some instances the cost would come down. If you just think about IPP, solar power is much cheaper than the Eskom power in some instances. So that definitely can be done cost effectively.
I'll need a quick answer to this one, and it's interesting. You talk about tax governance becoming a value driver in the supply chain. So how are manufacturers integrating tax strategy to unlock savings?
I think that's still a big challenge for them. We've seen that the manufacturing companies are actually the lowest percentage in terms of tax transparency. And if we think tax, even though the net profit came down, tax went up 43%. So for us, that's a major area of focus that manufacturers have to think about: tax governance, tax transparency, and all the different elements of tax within your entire value chain to bring about those cost-effective changes. It's definitely a big saving opportunity that sits out there.
Peter Theron from PwC, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Well, as the rhetoric intensifies and the American presidential race heats up with just over a week to go, South African investors are obviously watching closely. The potential economic impact of the election is big, from taxes to trade policies to the future of big tech and energy. The outcome could shape global investment strategies for quite some time to come, and obviously for this country as well. Joining us now is Rashad Tayob, who is a macro strategist and portfolio manager at FUD. And Rashad, first of all, let's focus on the tax policies first. How would each candidate's policies affect South African investors? Obviously, we're looking at corporate and capital gains.
The interesting thing about the tax policies is that Trump, in his first term, cut tax quite aggressively. He cut the corporate tax rate from 35% down to 21%. He cut the personal income tax marginally from 39% to 37%. But under Biden, they actually kept those in place. Trump, in his second term, if he wins, which is looking increasingly likely, is promising to cut the corporate tax rate even further, from 21 down to 15% for domestic manufacturers. So that would be amongst the lowest rates in the world. And that would be a massive boost to corporates in the US. And, you know, for South Africans with exposure to global markets, a big portion of that is into U.S. companies, and therefore corporates in America will benefit from lower tax rates potentially under President Trump.
And both candidates have targeted big tech, but in different ways. So how would their different approaches particularly impact global portfolios? And there are people in this country with a heavy exposure to U.S. tech stocks.
So I think there's two issues here. One is that the regulatory issues, and I think given the history, Republicans are just far less prone to regulation. The Democrats generally favor more regulation and more controls. So I think under a potential Harris administration, I think you're going to see more antitrust, more attempts to exert control over the tech industry. I think he does hold a little bit of resentment against the social media companies, Google and Facebook, because they did a campaign against him and they did put in place things which impacted him negatively from a social media perspective in his first administration. So they were almost like an opposition to him. And I think he does resent that, although they have evolved. And you know, if you look at Mark Zuckerberg, his politics is evolving, and I think that they're less likely to be anti-Trump in his second administration. I think he also realizes that the big tech companies, they pose a challenge for Americans' dominance. And I think as an America First type of president, he doesn't necessarily want to curtail their power and their influence when they are, you know, doing such a good job in terms of dominating global tech.
So we've looked at tech, we've looked at tax. Let's look at trade now, and trade relations with China, a hot topic, I guess, in any election. How would tariffs and protectionist policies from either candidate affect our trade and investment landscape, if in fact it would?
So if you listen to Trump in his recent interviews, he's been very vocal on tariffs. He calls it the most beautiful word in the dictionary. And I think he's, when he throws out numbers of 100%, 200%, it is quite scary. But I mean, if you see his history and even read his book, The Art of the Deal, there's a lot of just negotiation and positioning that goes on in when he throws out those numbers. So I don't think we should take them for granted. However, he was the one who started the campaign against China in terms of its domination of global trade. If you look at what they've done, they've basically taken over global manufacturing over the last two decades. They've decimated manufacturing in the US, but all over the world. And I think he is trying to undo some of that and make the US somewhat independent. And tariffs are going to be part of that. The risk is that he while China to date is still running a record surplus, they haven't really been as aggressive in responding to the tariffs, responding to the controls on chips, for example. They're playing the long game. And the risk is that they, at some point, are forced to respond and it ignites a trade war. Because if you put tariffs on me, it's obvious that I will attempt to put tariffs on you, and that could potentially spiral out of control. You end up with high inflation and lower growth, which is a very poor outcome for the world.
Energy policy is another area of stark contrast. I think you'll agree with me. So you've got Kamala Harris with a big push on renewables, and Donald Trump is very pro-drilling. Again, this would have an impact on global energy markets, and there would be a trickle down to South African investments.
So the U.S. has, over the last decade, quietly become an energy superpower. So they've added a Saudi Arabia worth of oil production in the last decade and are the biggest producer in the world. Not many, when you think about oil powers, you don't necessarily think about the United States, but they are the biggest producer in the world. And I think despite the fact that there are constraints under a Democratic administration, there are taxes, pipelines being shut, I think the demand for oil has continued, and effectively businesses find a way. And under a Trump administration, what you're likely to see is an easing of controls, which would potentially lead to lower oil prices and potentially higher growth. Now, obviously, what that does to, you know, the green energy transition and those type of opportunities, I think renewables companies could come under a little pressure. And anyone dependent on those for returns, they could suffer if the U.S., as the biggest economy in the world, begins to pull back on some of these subsidies for green energy.
Well, all will be revealed on the 5th of November. Rashad Tayob, thank you very much indeed. Macro strategist and portfolio manager at FURD. I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much. And just before I go on our last online poll, South Africans can look forward to an average salary increase of about 6% next year. And I asked you if that was about right or an optimistic view, and more than half of our respondents going for the latter. And today my question to you, are you bullish about a grey list departure? It's either a yes or no, I guess, or not quite yet. If you have a view on that, please participate either on our LinkedIn or X feeds, and we'll have the results for you on the next program. That's also our show for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening. And goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.